but presuming this was beyond her both financially and technically, she'd have to point it out in some other unsubtle way. She was going to make him look, though, whatever it took. There was no doubt about that. She left a message for him on his cell when she knew he'd be teaching. "Hello, it's me. Listen, I'm sorry about the other night. I know you were trying to be friendly, and I can see how you might have needed someone to share the news with. Anyway, if you want to try again, I promise I'll be more receptive." He called her at work on his lunch break.
"That was very sweet of you."
"Oh, that's okay."
"Pretty amazing, though, no?"
"Incredible."
"There's a picture up on the website."
"I might have a look at it later." There was a silence. He was so transparent, and she felt an unfamiliar tug of affection. He wanted to keep the conversation going, and he was also looking for an elegant way to turn this tiny spark of interest into something warmer and cozier. It wasn't that he wanted her back, necessarily, she understood that, but she was sure he'd have been hurt and bewildered by her anger. And he'd be homesick, too. He hated not having his things around him, even on holiday.
"Can I come around for a cup of tea sometime?"
Elegance had proved beyond him. He'd settled for desperation, in the hope that she'd respond to his neediness.
"Well, at a time convenient to you, of course."
As if the inconvenience, rather than the infidelity and the mess it had caused, might be responsible for the hesitation.
"Maybe later in the week? Let the dust settle a bit."
"Oh, really? Is there still, you know, dust?"
"There is round here. I don't know what it's like at your place."
"I suppose if I say it's not dusty, you'll think, I don't know, that everything's all okay for me."
"I just think you hadn't noticed, to be honest, Duncan. You never used to notice when you were living here."
"Ah, I thought we were talking about metaphorical dust."
"We were. But there's always room for a joke, surely."
"Ha ha, yes, of course. Whenever you want, I'm sure I deserve a bit of teasing."
She was suddenly overwhelmed by the sheer hopelessness of her relationship with Duncan. It wasn't just hopeless in its current form, it had always been hopeless. It was an unsuitable internet date with an inadequate, unexciting man that had lasted for years and years and years. And yet something was making her flirt with him.
If flirting could ever include bitterness and exclude fun, joy, and the promise of sex.
It was the rejection, she decided.
And rejection in Ghoulness was a special kind of rejection.
What about Thursday?
The truth was, she didn't want to wait that long. She wanted him to see the picture as soon as possible. She could see, however, that desperately wanting someone not to recognize a photo of someone else was unattractive and possibly even indicative of a spiritual crisis. Terry Jackson, the town councillor, was unhappy at the lack of progress with the 1964 exhibition and had come to the museum to tell Annie as much.
"So at the moment, the centerpiece of the exhibition would be what? The pickled shark's eye? Because it's hard to imagine anyone wanting to look at that for long."
"We don't really believe in centerpieces."
"Don't we?"
"No, we..."
"Let me put it another way, then. Is the shark's eye the best thing we've got?"
"The idea is that we collect so many great things that we don't talk about the best thing we've got." Every time Annie met Terry Jackson, she was distracted by his hair, which was grey, but thick and lovingly shaped by Brill Cream. How old had he been in 1964? 20? 21? Ever since he'd outlined his dream exhibition, which she had been naive enough and arrogant enough to believe she could turn into a reality, she'd had the feeling that he had left something behind in that year, and that she could help him get it back. The shark's eye clearly wasn't going to do it for him.
"But you haven't got any great things."
"We haven't got enough, certainly."
"I can't say I'm not disappointed, Annie, because I am."
"I'm sorry, it's a very hard thing to pull off. I think that even if we decided to widen it out and try for a Ghoulness in the 1960s exhibition, we'd have had difficulties."
"I can't believe that," he said. This place was bonkers in the 1960s. Loads of stuff going on.
I can believe it.
No, you can't,
he said sharply.
You're just pretending you can believe it to humour me. The truth is, you think this place is a dump and you always have done. You'd love to put a shark sign in an empty room and tell everybody it's summed up ghoulness. You'd think it was funny. I knew we should have got a local girl in to run this place, someone with a feel for it.
I know I wasn't brought up here, Terry, but I'd like to think I've developed an affinity with the town.
Codswallop, you can't wait to leave. Well, now your boyfriend's run off, you can't you? Nothing keeping you here.
She studied the wall behind his head hard, in an attempt to retract the one tear that seemed to be forming in her right eye. Why the right? Was it one of those things where the right tear duct was connected to the left side of the brain, and it was the left side of the brain that processed emotional trauma? She had no idea, but trying to work it out helped.
I'm sorry, said Terry. I had no right to bring up your personal life. It's a great town, Ghoulness, but it is a small town, I'll give you that. My nephew's at the college, and they all seem to know up there.
Don't worry. And of course, you're right. There's less to tie me down to the town than there was, but I would like to try and get this exhibition on before I leave. If I leave.
Well, that's very nice of you, and I'm sorry I got a bit hot under the collar about the lack of progress.
That year, I can't explain it. Everything seemed magical to me, and I thought it might to everyone else, and they'd all come flooding out of their houses with...
That's been part of my problem, you see, Terry. I'm not sure what they'd be donating either.
Well, I never threw anything away. I kept every newspaper, every cinema ticket, every bloody bus ticket just about. I've got one of those old-fashioned blue and red posters advertising the Rolling Stones, plus Bill Wyman's autograph, because he was the only bugger who'd give me one. I've got photos of my mam standing outside Grant's department store the day before they knocked it down. I've got a box full of bloody shark photos. I've got pictures of me and me mates down at the old Queen's Head before they turned it into that cheesy nightclub.
I wonder if you might think of lending us some of that. She was as polite and as understated as she could be in the circumstances. If she killed him, though, she was pretty sure a jury would understand, provided they'd been briefed on the recent history of small museum funding and the restrictions that placed on any kind of imaginative exhibiting.
Nobody wants to look at my old rubbish. I certainly don't. I want to look at somebody else's.
But would you mind if I looked at it?
For ideas, you mean? Get a better picture?
Well, that too, yes.
Oh, if you must.
Thank you. And I wouldn't rule out lending us some of your memorabilia.
You'd have to be pretty desperate.
Yes, she said. Well, and left it at that. He was right, of course. She had never taken Ghoulness seriously, and neither had Duncan. That, after all, was one of the strongest and richest connections between them. Their contempt for the town they lived in, and the people they lived with. That was why they'd been matched up in the first place, and that was why they'd stayed together, huddled against the cold winds of ignorance and philistinism. So what sort of curator did that make her, if she'd never been persuaded that there was a past or a present worth curating? All she and Duncan had ever been able to see was a lack of culture, and you couldn't put a lack of culture in a museum. Yes, she could leave, and most of her wanted to leave. Nothing was keeping her in Ghoulness, just as Terry had said, apart from some nagging and probably deluded conviction that she was nicer than the sort of person who wouldn't want to stay. Duncan knew that she got home at 6, so he turned up at about 3 minutes past. Annie had made sure she was back by 1:45, though, so that she'd have time to do things that turned out not to need doing. It didn't take her as long to hang up her coat as she'd anticipated, and the photo on the fridge didn't actually need moving 3 inches to the left, then 3 inches to the right, and then back to where it had been all the time. And he didn't look at it anyway. He didn't really look at anything.
I suppose you knew straight away that I was making a terrible mistake,
he said when she asked him if he wanted a cookie. He was hunched over his tea and staring at the handle on his Tony B. Lyre mug. She thought about giving him one of the others in case drinking out of this one made him weepy, but he hadn't noticed it.
The truth is, I'd have been making a terrible mistake even if I'd been single for all those years.
even if I'd been desperate for...
Annie stared at her own mug. She had no intention of asking him questions about Gina.
You see, the thing is, I think she might be mad.
You shouldn't be so hard on yourself.
I know that's supposed to be a joke, but to tell you the truth, that's one of the reasons I've come to that conclusion. She acts as though it's some kind of miracle that we found each other, that she got a job at the college and there I was waiting for her. Well, I know I'm nothing much.
Annie felt the same little pang she'd noticed on the phone the other night, but she was beginning to wonder whether it wasn't just a straightforwardly human pity. She was relieved he'd gone, and he was worried that another woman's interest in him was evidence of her insanity. How could she not feel protective?
"It's all very difficult, isn't it?" he said. "This whole business of whatever you want to call it."
"I'm not sure what it is. What would you call it?"
"Knowing somebody?"
"Ah."
"Well, I knew you, know you. That seems to me important. More important than I'd realized. The other night, when I called you, I mean, I know it was about Tucker, and I said silly things about how Tucker was sort of our child, even though not having a child was a delicate topic, but the impulse... You see, I don't really want to tell her anything. Any news I have doesn't belong to her.
Give it time.
I'm just not cut out for this sort of change, Annie. I want to live here, with you, and tell you things.
You can always tell me things. Annie's heart sank. She couldn't think of a single thing Duncan was ever likely to tell her that she'd actually want to know.
That's not what I mean.
Duncan, we've been more friends than lovers for quite a long time. Maybe we should think about making that relationship official. His face lit up, and for a moment Annie thought she was safely on to the other bank.
Marriage, you mean? Because I'd be happy to...
No, no, you're not listening. The opposite of marriage. A non-matrimonial, non-sexual, once-a-week-in-the-pub friendship.
Oh.
Annie was beginning to resent the unfairness of all this. The one good thing about being rejected by Duncan was that she didn't have to end the relationship herself. Now, suddenly, it would appear that she had to both get dumped and do the dumping. How had that happened? The truth is, she said, acutely conscious that the phrase was being used to introduce an absurd lie, I've sort of kind of started seeing somebody. I mean, it's very, very early days, and we haven't... If the somebody in question was who she thought it was, and there were no other candidates that came to mind, then actually met with the two words missing from the end of that sentence. But Tucker wouldn't mind, she felt. He knew how fiction worked and what it was for.
You're seeing somebody? I'm aghast.
If ever Duncan wanted to know the reason why people sometimes found him insufferable, she could point him toward that description of his inner turmoil. Who used the word aghast without irony? I was pretty aghast myself when you told me about Gina.
Yes, but...
He was clearly hoping he wouldn't have to expand on the differences between his situation and her own, which were, of course, more profound than he knew. What if they weren't? What if Gina were as imaginary as Tucker? This was a more plausible explanation, surely, than the one she'd been expected to swallow. That a woman would take one look at Duncan and usher him straight into her bed. Actually, it wasn't Duncan's appearance that was the problem. It was harder to believe that a woman would spend an evening talking to Duncan and still want to sleep with him. But what?
Well, Gina was a given. She was known information. This is something entirely new.
Gina's quite new. To me, anyway. And anyway, what is she? Some kind of nuclear strike that's supposed to disable the opposition?
I'm not allowed a life because you got one first?
Duncan looked pained.
There's a lot in there I'd like to take issue with.
Feel free.
In order. A. I don't like to think you're the opposition. That is not how I think of you. And B, the whole thing of getting a life. I'd like to think you had one already, even before we split up. And as I've been trying to explain to you, I'm not sure I do have a life. Not in the sense you mean. Anyway, we're getting away from the point. The point being, you've met somebody.
Yes.
Do I know him?
For a moment, Annie was tempted to upbraid him for his presumptuous use of the masculine pronoun, but she couldn't have fun both ways. She couldn't expect much mileage out of the photo on the fridge if she also wanted to convince him that she'd become a lesbian. Did Duncan know him? Well, yes and no. Mostly no, she decided. No.
That's something, I suppose. Had you...
I'm not sure I really want to talk about my situation, Duncan. It's private.
I understand. But it would help me if you could answer one more question.
Help you how?
Had you met him before we... Before I... Before recent events?
We'd had... contact, yes.
And does he...
That's it, Duncan. Sorry.
Fair enough. So, where does that leave us?
Pretty much where we were, I'd have thought. You're seeing someone, living with someone, and I'm seeing someone. Someone looking at the situation from the outside would say that we've moved on. Especially you. Annie hoped that this outside observer spent more time looking through Gina's window than her own.
I know what it looks like, but... Oh, God, are you really going to make me go through with this?
With what?
Gina.
Duncan, will you listen to yourself?
What have I said?
I'm not making you do anything. If you don't want to be with Gina, you should tell her, but it's nothing to do with me.
I can't tell her. Not if there's nothing to tell.
What are you talking about?
Well, if I went back and said, you know, Annie and I are getting back together, or Annie's suicidal and I can't leave her, I'm sure she'd understand. But I couldn't just say, you know, you're mad, could I?
Well, no, I hope you wouldn't say that to anyone.
So what should I say?
It sounds to me as though you've moved too quickly. You should tell her that. Oh, Duncan, this is absurd. A couple of weeks ago, you told me you'd met somebody else, and now you want me to script the breakup.
I'm not asking you to script it. I just need a rough outline. Anyway, if I do say something to her, where am I going to live?
So you'd be prepared to carry on with her forever rather than look for a flat?
I was hoping to come back here.
I know, Duncan, but we've split up. It wouldn't be appropriate.
Half this house is mine.
I've applied to increase the mortgage and buy you out. I don't know whether they'll let me, but the guy at the building society thought I had half a chance. And if you need to borrow some money before that, I can help. It seems only fair. The longer this conversation went on, the quicker Annie's ambiguities and confusions cleared up. Duncan's obvious regret helped immensely in the usual unhealthy way. Now that she wasn't actually being rejected, it was quite clear to her that she didn't want to be with him a moment longer, and her sense of grievance gave her a force and clarity that she wished were always accessible to her.
I never thought you'd be so... tough.
And I'm tough because I've just offered to lend you money.
Well, yes, you'd rather lend me money than have me back.
And another thing. He was stingy on top of everything else. Duncan would rather stay in a relationship with a woman he didn't like than lend her a few quid. Make me another cup of tea, will you? I'm just nipping upstairs to the loo. She didn't need to go, and she didn't want another drink, and she didn't want Duncan to stay. But he'd have to go to the fridge for the milk, and if he went to the fridge, he couldn't fail to notice the photo. By the time she came back, he was staring at it.
That's him, isn't it?
I'm sorry, I should have taken it down.
I don't wish to be rude, but is that his son or grandson?
Annie was momentarily disconcerted. She had got lost in all the layers of irony. Duncan was missing so much crucial information that all he'd been left with was a photo of a bespectacled, silver-haired man with a young boy.
That is rude, actually. I'm sorry, it just wasn't immediately obvious.
It's his son. He's only your age.
He wasn't, but he could have been, more or less. He's probably been around the block a couple of times then. Any other kids?
Duncan, I'm sorry, but I think you should leave. I'm not comfortable with these questions. It really hadn't been as much fun as she'd hoped. She still had his email, though, and she'd only read it through once. She'd printed it at work along with a photograph, and she'd put it in an envelope to keep it from getting dog-eared and dirtied by all the detritus at the bottom of her work bag. After she'd made herself something to eat, she sat down and unfolded it, but stood up again when she decided she'd like to wear her reading glasses. She hardly ever bothered with them. She was reminding herself of somebody. The letter, because that's what it was now, the glasses, the armchair. How many times had she watched her mother and grandmother sit down to pay proper attention to something that had come in the mail? And who were all those people who wrote to them? Names started to come back, names she hadn't heard in years. Betty in Canada. Who was Betty? Why was she in Canada? How come Gran knew her? Auntie Vi in Manchester, who wasn't an auntie. When Annie was in her mid-teens and had thus become surly and superior, she couldn't keep herself from feeling that there was something depressing about the good cheer that invariably accompanied the arrival of those letters. Who cared if Betty's niece was pregnant or if Auntie Vi's grandson was a trainee vet? If Mum and Gran weren't so isolated and bored, none of this would be regarded as news. And now, here Annie was, allowing her day to become gloriously coloured by a communication from a man she'd never even met. Chapter 10. In the last email Annie had sent Tucker, she posed the following question. What do you do if you think you've wasted 15 years of your life? She'd had no reply as yet, possibly because of the domestic turmoil he'd hinted at the last time he'd written, so she'd had to address the problem on her own. She was currently working on the assumption that time was money. What would she do if she just lost £15,000? It seemed to her that there were two alternatives. You could either write it off or try to get it back. And you could try to get it back either from the person who took it from you in the first place or by trying to compensate for the loss in other ways, by selling stuff or betting on a horse or doing lots of overtime. This analogy was only helpful up to a point, obviously. Time wasn't money. Or rather, the time she was talking about couldn't be converted into cash, like the services of a lawyer or a prostitute. Or rather, one last or rather, otherwise she'd have to concede that this whole way of thinking about time wasn't working. It could, theoretically, but nobody was going to pay her. She could knock on Duncan's, Gina's, door and demand compensation for the time she'd wasted on him, but the value would be difficult to calculate. And anyway, Duncan was cheap. She didn't want money, though. She wanted the time back to spend on something else. She wanted to be 25 again. If she hadn't wasted so much time with Duncan, she might be better equipped to work out where it had gone. She had never been very good at algebra, and algebra was, it seemed to her, what was needed for the kind of thinking she wanted to do. One of the traps she kept falling into, and she couldn't help it, even though she was aware of it, was to equate time with Duncan as time generally. T equals D, when of course T really equaled D plus W plus S plus F and F plus C, where W is work, S is sleep, F and F is family and friends, C is culture, and so on. In other words, she'd wasted only her romantic time on Duncan, whereas life consisted of more than that. In her own defense, though, she would like to point out that D was more than just one element to rack up alongside the others. She saw his, F and F, for example, as well as her own, although admittedly he had fewer of both. Who knows whether W would have been different if D hadn't been living in the same town? She was guessing it might have been. They stayed put, doing jobs that satisfied neither of them, because finding new work in the same place at the same time would have been almost impossible. And whose C was it, anyway? He was the one who bought the music and the DVDs. He was the one who didn't like going to the theatre, or to other towns to see it. She couldn't do equations, really, but she thought it was probably more like T equals W plus S plus F and F plus C over D. And there was another part of the equation that she didn't like thinking about. Her own stupidity and torpor. O-S-T. She had played a part in all this. She had allowed her life to drift. She would have to multiply the whole bloody lot by O-S-T, thus ending up with a number greater than the one she'd first thought of. And if it turned out she'd wasted 20 or 50 or 100 years, then whose fault was that? The 15 years were gone anyway. And what had gone with them? Children, almost certainly. And if she ever did take Duncan to court, that's what she would sue him for. But what else? What hadn't she done because she'd spent too much time with a boring, faithless nerd apart from live the kind of life she'd wanted when she was 25? She kept coming back to sex. It was reductive and unimaginative, she knew that. But it was also unarguable. Duncan had kept her from having sex with other people, and quite often with him. They'd never been the most highly sexed couple. But whoever kept score of these things would say he'd turn down her overtures more often than she'd turn down his. How could she make up for 15 years of missed opportunity, aged 39? And how much sex was that anyway? Suppose she'd met somebody she loved passionately 15 years ago, and the relationship had endured. Then it would be 15 years of sex with other men, OM, minus 15 years of sex with Duncan. To include quality, Q in the calculation, would require a mathematical sophistication that was beyond her capabilities, even though it was probably necessary to give an accurate final figure. In other words, she wanted to see if anyone would want to have sex with her. Where to start in ghoulness? She asked Roz, first of all on the grounds that Roz was younger and that younger people were closer to sex than she was.
I can tell you how to meet gay women in London, Roz said.
Right. Thanks. I'm going to aim at straight men in ghoulness first, but I might get back to you if it doesn't work out.
What is it you're actually after? A one-night stand?
Maybe. If it stretched into a second night, I wouldn't complain. Unless, of course, the first night was horrific.
Don't you know any single men?
No. I'm not sure there are any. Not the kind you're looking for. What am I looking for?
Well, Ghoulinus has clubs and lads, and...
But... I know the next four words you're going to say.
What?
With all due respect. Roz laughed.
We could go out, she said, if you want.
But you're...
Gay? Married?
Both.
Here's the thing. I wouldn't be looking. I'd be helping you to look. We, in the meantime, would be having a night out. And if it looks as though you're in luck, I will make my excuses and leave. Unless you need me for anything.
Don't be disgusting.
Don't be prudish. Things have changed since you last slept with somebody for the first time.
Unless there's been someone you haven't told me about. No. Duncan, in 1993. Blimey, you're in for a shock. That's what worries me. What sort of shock am I in for?
I just imagine a world of pornography and sex toys. And I'm presuming that there is always a minimum of three people involved.
Oh, God.
And then, 5 minutes after you've finished doing it with a minimum of 2 other people, explicit images of your 39-year-old body will start appearing on your friends' mobile phones. And all over the internet, of course, but that goes without saying.
Right. Well, if that's what you have to do.
Ideally, you'd want someone like you, wouldn't you? I don't mean, you know, a female museum curator. I mean someone who's just come out of a long relationship and is similarly perplexed by what happens now.
I suppose.
Let me think. What are you doing Friday night?
Annie looked at her.
Yes, right, sorry. Let's meet in the Rose and Crown at 7, and I'll bring a plan with me.
A sex plan?
A sex plan.
The Rose and Crown, halfway between the museum and the college, was their usual meeting place. It was an unexceptional downtown pub, usually half full of shop assistants and office workers too intimidated to drink in some of the seaside bars, all of which seemed to employ DJs even on Sunday at lunchtime. Annie wondered whether there was, anywhere in the country, a DJ wondering how to break into the business. It seemed unlikely, given the number of establishments that seemed to think they needed one. On the contrary, she suspected demand was such that young people had to be coerced into playing music in bars whether they wanted to or not, like a form of national service. Anyway, the Rose and Crown had a jukebox that offered Vince Hill's version of Edelweiss, an offer that was only rarely taken up, in Annie's experience. It was hard to imagine many sex plans being drawn up in there. And if any were, they would be safe sex plans, drawn up slowly and running to several pages of warnings. Roz bought 2 half pints of pale ale, and they sat down at the back of the pub, away from a quiet group of fragrant-looking women who appeared as though they were trying to understand the root cause of a particularly bad day's profits at the body shop. Annie realized she was nervous, or excited, or something. Not because she seriously believed that there would be a plan, but because somebody was about to demonstrate interest in how she might spend part of the rest of her life. It had been a very long time since she had provided anyone with anything to talk about. She was somebody's project. She hadn't even been her own project for a while.
"There's a book group," said Roz,
"but not in Ghoulness, you know, proper. In a village just outside. You could borrow my car."
"And there are single men in it?"
"Well, no, not at the moment. But a friend who belongs feels that if there were any single arts graduate males in the area, that's where they'd wash up eventually. There was one a couple of years ago, apparently. Anyway, just a thought. And the other one I had was that we could go away for the weekend. To Barcelona, maybe, or Reykjavik, if Iceland still exists."
"So let's get this straight. The best way to have sex in Ghoulness is either to join a book club not actually in the town with no men in it, or to go to another country."
"These are just initial ideas. Others will come. And we haven't even touched on internet dating.
Ah, look, as if by magic."
2 men in their early 40s had come into the pub. While one was at the bar buying 2 pints of lager, the other was examining the jukebox. Annie studied him and tried to imagine taking off her clothes for him or with him. Would he even want her to? She had absolutely no idea whether she was even passably attractive. She felt as though she hadn't looked in a mirror for years. She was about to ask Roz, and surely having a lesbian friend would be helpful, or was that not how it worked, when he started shouting at his friend.
"Gav! Gav!"
The music he'd chosen came on. A bright, fast, and tinny soul song that sounded like Tamla Motown, but wasn't.
"Fucking hell," said Gav. "Go on, Barnsley, get yourself warmed up."
"Too much carpet," said Barnsley, who was small, skinny, and muscular, and wearing baggy trousers and a Fred Perry sports shirt.
If he was 16 years old, and she was his teacher, Annie would have had him pegged for the kind of kid who would start a fight with the biggest guy in the class just to show that he wasn't scared. He put down the duffel bag he was carrying anyway, despite the carpet. It clearly wouldn't take much to push Barnsley over the edge, even though it wasn't entirely clear what lay beneath.
"Don't make excuses," said Gav. "These ladies want to see what you've got, don't you, ladies?"
"Well," said Roz, "some of it."
That, Annie thought, was the sort of thing she'd have to come up with if she were ever to start picking up men in pubs. It was the speed that intimidated her. It wasn't as if some of it was a Wildean one-liner, but it did the job, and both men laughed. Annie, meanwhile, was still trying to twist her mouth into a polite smile. It would take her 5 minutes to complete the smile, and probably another 24 hours to produce an accompanying snappy verbal response. Gavin Barnsley would probably have left by then. What Barnsley had, it turned out, was an extraordinary array of gymnastic dance moves which he proceeded to demonstrate for the duration of the song. To Annie's untutored eye, Barnsley was a heady mix of breakdancer, martial arts warrior, and Cossack. There were spins and flailing arms and push-ups and kicks. But it was his complete lack of embarrassment, his absolute confidence that what he was doing was something the half-dozen people in the pub would want to see, that was really impressive.
"Good God!" said Roz when he'd finished. "What was that?"
"What do you mean, what was that?"
"I've never seen anything like it."
"You don't live in Gulnes, then?"
"I do, actually, we both do."
"And you've never seen Northern Soul dancing?"
"I can't say I have. You, Annie?"
Annie shook her head and blushed. What was the blush for, actually? Why was she embarrassed to say that she hadn't seen Northern Soul dancing before? She wanted to punch her stupid, treacherous cheeks in.
"That's what Gulnes is," said Barnsley. "The Gulnes all-nighters. We've been coming here since 81, haven't we, Gav?"
"Where from?"
"Scunny, Scunthorpe."
"You come all the way to Gulnes from Scunthorpe to do Northern Soul dancing?"
"Course we bloody do, only 50 miles.
Gav came back from the bar with their beers and put them down on the table at which Annie and Roz were sitting.
"What are you doing tonight?"
For a moment, Annie had the absurd notion that Roz was going to tell them precisely what they were doing and that Gav and Barnsley, or both, would offer themselves up as the solution to the sex problem. She didn't think she wanted sex with either of them.
"Nothing," said Annie quickly.
The speed of the response, the eagerness it seemed to contain, was the diametric opposite of what she was after. By jumping in to stop Roz from talking about the sex plan, it seemed to her, she was more or less offering sex.
"Well, there we are, then,"
said Gav, who seemed too chubby to be a Northern Soul dancer if Barnsley's moves were indicative of the kind of stuff a Northern Soul dancer needed to strut.
"We're laughing, aren't we? Two good-looking men, two good-looking women."
"Roz here is gay," said Annie, and then, helpfully, "a lesbian," as if this might clear up any doubts anyone had about the variety of homosexuality Roz subscribed to. If she had succumbed to the temptation to punch her own cheeks in earlier, the chances are that she wouldn't have been able to say anything quite so mortifyingly crass. Roz, to her credit, merely groaned and rolled her eyes. She would have been entitled to walk out of the pub and never contact Annie again.
"Annie?"
"A lesbian," said Gav. "A real one, in Gulnes."
"She's not a lesbo,"
said Barnsley.
"How can you tell?"
said Gav.
"It's just what birds say when they don't like the look of you. Do you remember those two at the Blackpool all-nighters? Told us they weren't into men, and then we saw them with the tongues down the throats of the DJs."
Roz laughed. "I'm sorry if it seems like a brush-off," she said, "but I was gay long before you two walked in."
"Fucking hell," said Barnsley in wonderment. "You just walk around gay-like?"
"Yep."
"I've got to tell you,"
said Gav, with sudden excitement.
"I..."
"You don't have to tell me at all," said Roz.
"You don't even know what I was going to say."
"You were going to say that even though gay men make you sick to your stomach, the idea of gay women you find titillating in the extreme."
"Oh,"
said Gav.
"You've heard that before, have you?"
"How does that work, anyway?"
said Barnsley.
"If one of you's gay and the other one isn't."
"How does it work?"
said Roz. And then, "Oh, no, we're not together, we're friends."
"Lesby friends,"
said Gav.
"Get it?"
Barnsley punched him hard on the arm.
"That's the second stupid thing you've said, if you count the things she didn't let you say. How old are you, fucking idiot? Pardon me language, ladies. Anyway, it don't really matter, does it?"
"In what way?" said Roz.
"If you wanted to come with us. To be honest, I'm too tired for sex after an all-nighter anyway these days, so you being gay isn't as much of a problem as it might have been."
That's good to hear, said Roz.
I don't even know what Northern Soul is, said Annie. She was almost certain that there was nothing offensive in the admission, and, as far as she could tell, she had managed to make it without her face turning scarlet.
You don't know what it is, said Barnsley, flatly.
How can you not know what it is? You don't like music, is that it?
I do, I love music, but...
Who are you into, then?
Oh, you know, all sorts.
Like what?
This, she thought, was unbearable. Did this question still come up after all these years?
Clearly it did, and clearly it became harder to answer as you got older.
In the time before Duncan, it had been easy. She was young, and she liked exactly the same kind of music as the young man asking the question, who, like her, was either on his way to university or an undergraduate or recently graduated. So she could say that she listened to the Smiths and Dylan and Joni Mitchell, and the young man would nod and add The Fall to her list. Telling a boy in your class that you like Joni Mitchell was really another way of saying, if the worst comes to the worst and you knock me up, it'll be okay. Now, apparently, she was expected to tell people who were not just like her, people who might not have an arts degree. And she knew she was being presumptuous, but she had decided that Barnsley was not an English graduate. And she knew that she could not make herself understood. How could she, when she wasn't able to use some of the cornerstones of her vocabulary? Words like Atwood and Austin and Akebourne. And that was just the A's. It was terrifying, the prospect of having to engage with another human being without those crutches. It meant exposing something else, something more than bookshelves.
I don't know. I listen a lot to Tucker Crowe.
Was that true? Or did she just think a lot about Tucker Crowe? Was it her way of saying, I'm taken, by a man I've never met who lives in another country?
What's he? Country and bloody Western, I hate that shit.
No, no, he's more like, I don't know, Bob Dylan or Bruce Springsteen, Leonard Cohen.
I don't mind a bit of the boss sometimes. That Born in the USA is all right when you've had a few and you're driving home. Bob Dylan's for students, and I've never heard of the other one, Leonard.
But I do like soul music, too. Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, they're all right. But they're not Dobie Gray, are they?
Well, no, said Annie.
She didn't know who Dobie Gray was, but it was safe to assume that he, was neither Marvin nor Aretha.
What did Dobie Gray do, actually?
That was Dobie Gray, out on the floor.
And you like that one?
It's, I don't know, the national anthem of Northern. It's not a matter of liking it or not, it's a classic.
I see.
Yeah, Dobie. And then there's Major Lance and Barbara Mason and...
Right, I've never heard of any of them.
Barnsley shrugged. In that case, the shrug seemed to indicate there wasn't much he could do for her. And for a moment she could feel herself turning pedagogical, even though she was the one trying to do the learning.
You can do better than that, she wanted to say. I'm not expecting a Wreath lecture, but you could attempt to describe what the music sounds like.
She thought, inevitably, of Duncan. His earnestness, his desire always to make Tucker's music come alive through the words he used to talk about it. Maybe there was more to say about Tucker, what with the Juliet story and the Old Testament influences. But did that make it better, if there was more to unpack? And was Duncan more interesting as a result? Eventually, through patient probing, Annie and Roz learned that Northern Soul was so called because people from the north of England, especially in Wigan, liked it, which struck them both as remarkable and strangely empowering. There were very few areas in life, they felt, where people in Wigan and Blackpool had much influence on the terminology of Black American culture. The music had, for the most part, been made in the 1960s, and as far as they could tell, it sounded like Tamla Motown.
But most Tamla's too famous, see, said Gav.
Too famous?
Not rare enough. It's got to be rare.
So Duncan would, despite all indications to the contrary, find common ground with Gav and Barnsley after all. There was the same need for obscurity, the same suspicion that if a piece of music had reached a large number of people, it had somehow been drained of its worth.
Anyway, said Barnsley. You coming or what?
Annie looked at Roz, and Roz looked at Annie, and they shrugged and laughed and drained their glasses. The all-nighter took place in the Gulenus Working Men's Club, a place that Annie must have walked past 1,000 times without noticing. She tried to deal herself a feminism card by telling herself that she hadn't noticed because she wasn't welcome. But she knew it wasn't just that. The second word of the club's name was every bit as intimidating as the third. As they waited behind their new friends to pay, ladies she noted were half price tonight, which meant that she and Roz could get in for a fiver, Annie felt a weird sense of triumph. She was on the verge of discovering the real Gulenus, a town that had effectively evaded her for all these years. Barnsley had told them that what they were about to see, to participate in, even, if she screwed up her courage and danced, was what Gulenus was. He'd been quite emphatic about it. So as she walked down the stairs into the club, she was looking forward to a seething, teeming, wriggling, wiggling throng of dancers, many of whom she'd recognize. She wanted to see former pupils, local shopkeepers, museum regulars, all of whom would look at her as if to say, "Here we are, what kept you?" "This could be it," she thought. "This could be the night I feel I belong here." But when they turned the corner and got their first look at the dance floor beneath them, the triumph shrunk into a little hard knot of embarrassment. There were 30 or 40 people spread thinly around the large basement room, only a dozen or so of whom were dancing. Each dancer had acres of space to himself. Most of them were men, and most of them were dancing on their own. None of the dancers or the drinkers around the edge was young. It turned out that she'd known all the time what Gulenus was, a place whose best days were behind it. A place that held on grimly to what was left of the good times it used to have, back in the '80s, or the '70s, or the '30s, or the century before last. Gav and Barnsley stopped for a moment on the stairs and looked down wistfully.
"You should have seen it when we first started coming," said Gav. "It was mental."
He sighed.
"Why does everything have to fucking wither and die? Get the beers in, Barnsley."
If Gav or Barnsley had mentioned the withering and the dying, Annie thought, they might not have bothered to come. Roz and Annie understood that they were not being included in the round, so Roz went off to the bar while Annie watched an elderly man with a mane of grey hair try to decide whether he was going to dance or just tap his feet and snap his fingers. It was Terry Jackson, councillor with the treasure trove of old bus tickets, and when he noticed Annie, he looked startled and the finger snapping stopped.
"Bloody hell," he said. "Annie the museum lady. I wouldn't have thought this was your scene."
"It's old music, isn't it?" she said. She was quite pleased with that. It wasn't downright hilarious, but it was an appropriate and light-hearted response delivered moderately quickly.
"How do you mean?"
"Old music museums."
"Oh, I see. Very good. Who brought you along?"
She bridled a little. Why did she have to be brought along? Why couldn't she have discovered it for herself, come on her own, persuaded others to accompany her? She actually knew the answer to those questions. The bridling was unnecessary. "A couple of guys we met in the pub." She wanted to laugh at the sheer outlandishness of this most ordinary of explanations. She wasn't someone who met a couple of guys in a pub.
"I probably know them," said Terry. "Who are they?"
"Two chaps from Scunthorpe."
"Not Gav and Barnsley. They're legends."
"Are they?"
"Only because they've been coming from Scunny for 20-odd years, never miss. And Barnsley can dance, did you know that?"
"He showed us in the pub."
"He's serious. Always got his little tub of talcum powder."
"What does he do with it?"
"Sprinkles it on the floor. For grip, you see. That's what the serious ones do. Talc and a towel. That's what you keep in your sports bag."
"You're not serious then, Terry?"
"I can't dance like I could. But I wouldn't miss one. This is the last thing we've got left here, more or less. It's a sort of long goodbye to the old days when I had my scooter and we used to get into scrapes on the seafront. The mods up here all became Northern Solies. But it's not going to last much longer, is it? Look at us."
Suddenly, Annie saw everything too clearly, and she felt sick. It had all gone. The whole fucking lot. It was all over. Gulenus, Duncan, her childbearing years, Tucker's career, Northern Soul, all the exhibits in the museum, the long dead shark, the long dead shark's cock and his eye too, the 1960s, the working men's club, probably working men as well. She had come out tonight because she believed there had to be a present tense somewhere, and she'd followed Gav and Barnsley because she'd hoped they knew where it was. Is. And they dragged her to yet another haunted house. Where was the now? In bloody America, probably, apart from the bit that Tucker lived in, or in bloody Tokyo. In any case, it was somewhere else. How could people who didn't live in bloody America or bloody Tokyo stand it, all that swimming around in the past imperfect? They had children, these people. That was how they stood it. The realization rose slowly through the bitter ale she'd been drinking, and then slightly more quickly through the lager that lay on top of it, and the gin that lay on top of the lager. The increased speed, possibly a result of all the bubbles. That was why she wanted children, too. The cliché had it that kids were the future, but that wasn't it. They were the unreflective, active present. They were not themselves nostalgic, because they couldn't be. And they retarded nostalgia in their parents. Even as they were getting sick and being bullied and becoming addicted to heroin and getting pregnant, they were in the moment. And she wanted to be in it with them. She wanted to worry herself sick about schools and bullying and drugs. An epiphany, then. That seemed to be what it was. But epiphanies were a little like New Year's resolutions, Annie found. They just got ignored, especially if you experienced them during a Northern Soul night when you'd had a couple of drinks. She'd probably had 3 or 4 epiphanies in her entire life, and she'd been either drunk or busy every time. What good was an epiphany then? You really needed one on a mountaintop, a couple of hours before you were going to make a life-changing decision. But she couldn't recall ever having had these experiences singly, let alone in tandem. And in any case, what use was an epiphany that revealed to you that everything you did revolved around the dead and the dying? What was she supposed to do with that information? The consequence of ignoring her epiphany was that she stayed in the club and drank and danced a little with Pudgy Gav mostly, because Barnsley was off doing handstands and kung fu kicks and dusting the floor with talc, and because Roz left at around midnight with Annie's permission, and because Terry Jackson stayed at the bar drinking and getting morose about the good old days, when you could get into a fight without anyone running off whining to the bloody health and bloody safety brigade. And when she eventually left at 2 in the morning, Barnsley followed her out, and then home, and she found herself inviting a man she had only just met to spend the night on her couch, and then sitting on her sofa watching him attempting to do the splits while declaring his love for her.
"I do!"
"No, you don't."
"I bloody do. I bloody love you. I've loved you since I saw you in the pub."
"Because my mate turned out to be gay."
"That just made it easier to make me mind up."
Annie laughed and shook her head, and Barnsley looked pained. It was something, anyway. It was an anecdote, an event, a moment that didn't refer back to something earlier in her life or in the life of the country. This was happening now, in her living room. Maybe that was why she'd offered Barnsley the couch in the first place. Maybe she'd hoped he might do the splits while telling her he loved her, and gratifyingly, that was exactly what was happening.
"I'm not just saying it because I'm, you know, exerting myself acrobatically. It's the other way round. I'm exerting myself because I love you."
"You're very sweet," she said, "but I need to go to bed.
Can I come with you?"
"No."
"No? Just, like, no?"
"Just no."
"Are you married?"
"Do you mean, is my husband asleep in the marital bed, which is why I'm not letting you in there? No."
"So what's the problem?"
"There's no problem. Well, there is, actually. I'm seeing someone, but he lives in America." Consistency and repetition were beginning to make the lie feel something like the truth, in the way that a path eventually becomes a path if enough people walk along it.
"Well, there we are then. America."
He turned his palms upward to enforce the point he felt he'd just made. We don't have that kind of relationship.
Think about it.
Barnsey, there's nothing to think about.
I think you're wrong.
What is there to think about?
It's not about thinking, is it?
Said Barnsey passionately. So I was right. There's nothing to think about.
I'm getting a divorce, if that makes any difference. I've been thinking I would for a while, but meeting you has made my mind up for me.
You're married? Bloody hell, Barnsey, you've got a cheek.
Yes, but hear me out. She hates the all-nighters. She hates Northern. She likes bloody, I don't know, girls with big hair who've won them talent shows.
He stopped and seemed to consider what he'd just said.
Bloody hell. That's really true. We've got nothing in common, and I've only just realised how unsuited we are. I really am going to get a divorce. I'm not just saying that to you. I'm going to get one anyway.
Well, see how you feel when you get home.
My mind's made up.
I don't think you and I would do much better.
Why not? You had fun tonight, didn't you?
Well, yes, some fun. But to be honest, I spent much of the evening with Gav, or Terry Jackson, or Roz. You were on your own most of the time.
That's how I dance, though. The way I do it, with the handstands and all that, I have to be on my own on the dance floor. I wouldn't be like that if it were just you, you know, inside watching telly.
Do you mean you wouldn't be off on your own with your own telly, or do you mean that you wouldn't be doing handstands while our favourite programme was on?
Well, both. Neither. Me fishing I do on me own. I mean, I do already. I'm just saying.
It's good to be straight with each other right from the start.
You're taking the piss, said Barnsey mournfully.
I am a bit.
Fair enough. I'm talking rubbish, aren't I?
He stood up.
I think I'll be going.
I'm serious about the sofa.
That's very kind of you. But I wasn't very interested, to be honest. My game plan was always, you know, sex or bust.
But what's bust?
Bust is going back to the all-nighter. I don't usually crap out early. It's a tribute to you that I've wasted any time here at all.
Barnsey offered his hand, and Annie shook it.
It's been a pleasure, Annie. Not as much of a one as I'd have wanted, but, you know, can't have everything.
The next morning, she still wasn't entirely sure whether she'd dreamed him. Whether his small, muscular body and his talcum powder and his flips and spins were meant to be decoded by a psychoanalyst who would tell her that she had a peculiar view of male sexuality. She made the mistake of trying to explain her evening out the following morning in her session with Malcolm. She was possibly still a little drunk when she went to see him, and she decided that Malcolm's stuffiness would provide a satisfyingly easy target for her mood of tipsy recklessness. Talking to him about sex plans would be as much fun as squirting him with a water pistol. But she squirted, and he got wet, and then he sat there, looking sad, and she could no longer remember why she ever thought it would be fun.
A sex plan? You met up with a gay friend to prostitute yourself?
Where to begin with this? Her being gay isn't really relevant. Probably not there.
I didn't know there was a lesbian in Golanus.
Definitely not there, in fact. Malcolm was not going to find it easy to leave Roz's sexuality unexamined. There are at least two, but that's not...
Where do they go?
What do you mean, where do they go?
Well, I know I'm out of touch, but I've never heard of any lesbian bars or clubs here.
Malcolm, they don't need to go to lesbian clubs in the same way that you don't need to go to heterosexual pubs. Clubs aren't a necessary part of homosexuality.
Well, I don't think I'd be comfortable in a non-heterosexual pub.
They go to the cinema and to restaurants and pubs and people's houses.
Ah,
said Malcolm darkly.
People's houses.
The implication was clear. You could get up to almost anything in private homes behind closed doors. Maybe you should talk directly to her, said Annie, if you're so curious about ghoulinous lesbians. Malcolm blushed.
I'm not curious. I'm just interested.
I don't want to come across as egotistical, said Annie, but can we talk about me?
I don't know what you've come here to talk about.
My problems.
I've lost track of what they are. There seems to be a different one every week. We don't even mention your long monogamous relationship anymore. All those years seem to count for nothing. You're more interested in picking men